We're going to call to order the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. Today is Wednesday, February 7th. We do not yet have a quorum, but we're going to get started. So if I could have the credit card task force presentation, please come forward. We're going to start with Keith Carlson. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Keith Carlson. I happen to be the Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, but I'm also a member of the task force. Today I'm going to give you sort of an overview as to why the task force was created, its charge, the issues before it, and its recommendations and some options that it's providing for the legislature. A number of the other members of the task force are here today, and during the course of my presentation, I will introduce them. In terms of why the task force and what was its charge, it was actually created by a law enacted by the legislature last year. It was charged with determining the pluses and minuses of credit and debit card transactions with state and local governments from both the government and the consumer's point of view, and then IDing options to facilitate the use of credit and debit cards for transactions with those entities and the fiscal impacts of those options. The next page on the transaction, I'm working on a PowerPoint document that says Report of the Credit Card Task Force, identifies the members of the task force who served on the subcommittee that drafted its report. And among those here in the audience today are Ron Movitz, if you could raise your hand, Jerry Ingebrigtsen, both from the Department of Finance. Jerry chaired the committee. Mary Ellison and Pat McCormick, both from the Department of Public Safety, as well as Larry Aaliyah. Linda Notch from the Department of Natural Resources. Kevin Corbett from the Washington County Property Tax and Elections Division. Lori Economy Scholler from the City of Bloomington, Jennifer O'Rourke from the League of Minnesota Cities, and finally Molly Hines from the Deputy Registrar's Association. And all of us will be available to answer your questions following my presentation. As to what's the issue, basically the Federal Reserve has estimated nearly 45% of the transactions that occur in the nation now are by other than by cash. In 2003, they estimated that there were 36.6 billion check payments, and eclipsing that are the 44.3 billion transactions that were paid for by credit, debit cards, or electronic funds transfer, or ACH is another term that stands for automatic clearinghouse. The number of checks written in the nation has been declining at a 4.3% annual rate since 2000, so checks are just simply becoming less and less the means of exchange in the nation. The practices of the private sector are obviously accelerating that. You're no doubt receive weekly mailings soliciting you to open up new checking accounts with the enticements of cash back or airline miles. But another phenomena that you, if you think about it, may have noticing it, is more and more merchants are refusing to accept checks as payment because of the cost of collecting non-sufficient fund or NSF checks and the cost for they pay their banks for processing those checks. Unlike for individual consumers, businesses pay the banks for their services for clearing their checks.
If I could interrupt for just one moment, we do officially have a quorum, so I will formally call this meeting to order. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Continuing then, the last thing that sort of is an incentive for a merchant to transition to using credit cards as its means of exchange rather than checks or cash is that the liability for the consumer ultimately failing to pay is transferred from the merchant, from the vendor to the bank. If you fail to pay a credit card transaction, the vendor still gets the cash. The bank is the one who comes after you to make that collection, unlike checks where that liability rests with the merchant. On the next page of my handout is just one of the signs that you'll see more and more frequently where a merchant is refusing to receive checks as a means of exchange. Unfortunately, due to institutional and legal reasons, state and local governments have been slow to respond to these changing financial practices. Roughly 1% of the state's $26 billion of annual revenues come from credit card transactions. And on the following page is a breakdown by the agencies of their receipts for over-the-counter or face-to-face transactions where it was paid by credit card and the credit card fees they paid to facilitate those transactions. On the next page, then, is that same information, but in this instance where the transaction occurred on the Internet or by a phone interactive voice response system. And in addition to the receipts and the credit card fees paid to facilitate those transactions, there's a third column that indicates whether or not a convenience fee was charged on that. And I'll get into the issue of convenience fees shortly. Going on then, quite frankly, the credit card industry itself, with its restrictions, have hindered government's response to the changing financial market base. For face-to-face transactions, the industry generally bans the vendor from tacking on an additional charge or a convenience fee for the use of credit cards. One recent exception that MasterCard alerted us to when we met with them during the course of the deliberations of the task force is that they are setting up a pilot program where you can charge a convenience fee on a MasterCard face-to-face transaction through a kiosk or dedicated service counter line as long as you impose that service charge on everybody using that kiosk or service line. But the problem is that if that person happens to be a Visa card holder, Visa won't permit us to impose that service charge, and Visa cards are about 80% of the credit cards out there. So it's not necessarily a particularly viable alternative for us. As I mentioned then, the industry does allow a convenience fee to be charged for alternative channel transactions like the Internet, like interactive voice response, IVR phone systems, but the charge must be the same on all the users, regardless if they use credit cards or a cheaper, from the vendor's point of view, electronic funds transfer, EFT, or ACH, automatic clearinghouse type transaction. Next several pages are just a few examples of the sites of the various agencies where they allow credit cards or EFT to be used and shows you somewhat the variation in those charges. The first one is from the Department of Revenue site from what they call their e-file system, where you can pay basically any tax that they administer by what is called ACH, again, Automatic Clearinghouse Debit, where you give them your bank's routing number and checking account, and you allow them to debit or transfer money out of your checking account to make that payment. The department does not put on an additional fee for that service. The next one is further down on the same site where they provide you the alternative of paying your tax by credit card. They actually send you to a third party called Official Payments Corporation to handle that transaction, and you will be charged a 2.49% service charge if you choose to pay by that means. Finally, the last one is just the notice from the Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services online renewal site where you could renew your motor vehicle license tabs. If you use that service, regardless of your means of payment, whether it's credit card or an ACH debit, you will pay $1.25 for the privilege of doing that. I think by now you're probably asking, so what? Well, in succinct terms, one of the staff of Washington County put it best, hello, it's 2006, start accepting credit and debit cards. This was in response to a customer satisfaction survey that they ran on their service counter transactions, where over one-half of the complaints were due to the fact that they would not allow credit and debit cards to be used. In more detail, the problem is that more and more citizens are showing up at our service counters expecting to be able to use credit cards. When they refuse, that leads to frustration, particularly if that individual does not have a checkbook on them or does not have sufficient cash to complete the transaction, and they're told, I'm sorry, you're going to have to come back later when you have the cash or your checkbook with you. And that's basically the state of the deputy registrar type functions as an example that exists right now. Citizens are also frustrated when they're charged a service charge on the state or local government's internet sites or phone systems because they're not used to that when they go to a private vendor set on the internet. For example, if you buy a book on Amazon.com or you buy something on eBay, you're not charged a separate convenience fee for using a credit card. So, frankly, consumers can't understand why they are charged such a charge when they use a government site. And the latter frustrates the efforts of government to drive transactions to the internet to generate the processing cost savings that exist currently. In terms of the recommendations, in terms of why we can't get our act together, has state and local government to routinely accept credit and debit cards. First, there's an institutional reluctance, but also legal impediments to doing so. The private sector handles the cost of sales by credit by integrating the cost into the cost of the products or services that they serve. So when you go to Target and buy something, regardless of if you pay by cash, credit card, or check, you're charged the same price. It's totally transparent to you that, in fact, there's a cost to using that credit card, and they're recouping it by just raising the prices for everybody, not just credit card users. Further, for many state and local government entities, their fees or permit charges are dictated by statute, so we don't have the latitude, even if we wanted to adjust our pricing to offset the cost of allowing credit cards. A particularly problematic area is then in what are called what we call shared revenue transactions, where one entity is acting as an agent for another. And I'm sorry to keep on picking on the deputy registrars, but it's probably one of the best examples. Right now, the state of Minnesota does not operate any vehicle license renewal sites itself. It's all done by third party, both public and private deputy registrars. So the state's totally dependent on those or online transactions for actually collecting motor vehicle license renewals. And the problem occurs in that those deputy registrars are collecting the money, but then they're turning around and transferring the vast bulk of it within 24 hours to the state. And that creates an additional large incentive to allowing the use of credit cards. For example, on a two-year-old or older vehicle, the maximum renewal charge is going to be, including the filing fee, will be $103.50. $99 of that, once it's collected or remitted, has to be turned over to the state within 24 hours after that transaction or the close of business on the following day. If the entity allowed a credit card to be used on that, the cost that they would pay their bank for processing that would be around $2.35. So instead of netting $4.50, the gross filing fee, they would only get $2.15 as their reimbursement for the cost of processing that transaction, less than 50% what they do right now. So the fact of the matter is there's only one deputy registrar in the state right now that's accepting credit cards or credit cards for the deputy registrar function, and that's Hennepin County. And they're offsetting those costs by charging advertisers to put their messages, their advertising up on message boards that are in their service centers, not necessarily a viable option for practically any other deputy registrar in the state. Closing then, what are the task force recommendations? Well, I would highlight three of them. There are more in the report. But first is that if any local government or state agency chooses to accept credit or debit cards for transactions where they control the pricing of the merchandise or service, they should reasonably be expected to manage the cost of allowing credit and debit cards. And that, in fact, is the state of the what exists currently. Both state and local government are, in some instances, accepting credit cards, but in many other instances they are not, because they don't control the pricing. State and local government agents should consider forming partnerships to maximize their negotiating power and ultimately securing lower transaction costs. Basically, the charge you pay to the bank for them processing your credit card transactions is negotiable. It's not a fixed cost. And basically, the higher the volume is, the lower the service charge you pay to the entity. So if we could aggregate all state and local government entities together, we assumably could get a much better price, particularly for the lower volume transactors. Final recommendation that I'll highlight then, the state agencies, local governments, and other agents of the state should consider no-cost or low-cost alternatives for customers when using alternative payment channels, again, the Internet or IVR, interactive voice response phone systems, whenever feasible or possible. There are additional recommendations in the report that I'll just, I'd be happy to speak to, but for right now, I'll just suggest you look to the report. Final thing is, how do we deal with shared revenue transactions? And this is one area where basically the members of the task force could not agree on one recommendation. So instead, what we chose to do was to put out four options for you. The first of those options is just to continue the status quo, which in my opinion will mean for those shared revenue transactions, most entities will continue to deny customers, the citizens, the ability to use credit and debit cards for the reasons that I've already outlined. A second is to add an additional fee to the cost of certain transactions to offset the cost of using credit or debit cards. This would be, again, Deputy Registrar, instead of charging the $450 filing fee, you would charge a somewhat larger fee to offset the use of credit cards. Third option would be to increase the cost of the service or product itself that is being vended by the third party. So the cost of renewing a license would be increased, say, for a two-year-older vehicle from $99 to $105 or something like that. The difference between this recommendation and the previous recommendation is basically where the financial risk or cost rests. In this recommendation, where it's added to the license, the cost or the risk rests with the state agency. In the latter one, it rests with the third-party vendor, again, using the deputy registrar as the example, with the deputy registrar. The fee will assumably be set on some average basis, and whether or not you come out ahead or behind will depend on the amount of transactions you do by credit card. If you do a lot, you may come out behind. If you do a few, you may come out ahead with the increased filing fee. The final one is to amend state statute to require state agencies to absorb credit card transaction fees from its share of any shared revenue transactions. So instead of getting $100 for a permit, the state agency would only get the net approximately $98 or $97.50. So, Madam Chair, that kind of ends my presentation. I and the other members of the task force would be happy to answer any questions at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Can you explain to me what happens when the deputy registrars take a check, for example? They then transfer the funds within 24 hours, and then maybe that check isn't good. It bounces. There's not a real account. What happens? Please go ahead, Mr.
Madam Chair, the cost of that NSF, and I'll invite DPS to correct me if I'm wrong, rests with the individual deputy registrar. So the fact that it was a bounce check, they still remit the gross, and they're stuck with the NSF. They have to make attempts to collect it.
All right. Questions from members? All right. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this issue or share concerns about the report or
Madam Chair, as I mentioned, all of the members are here available to answer questions. Again, we have representatives from DPS, DNR, the Department of Finance, as well as several local government entities and the private deputy registrars. So if there are specific issues, it would be happy to answer those.
Okay. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I came in a little bit late. But I can understand a fee for the cost of a credit card, but on a debit card, you get the money immediately. It's electronically transferred out of my checking account into your checking account immediately. You know. Why is there a fee associated with that?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, and again, I'll invite some of the others to add to my... as far as the transaction cost to the vendor, on the debit cards that are out there today, my understanding is the fee for transacting, for processing that transaction by your bank is essentially the same as it is for a credit card. So even though you do have the advantage because you no longer have to deal with this float issue, although it's not as much as you think, processing fee you pay to the bank, the credit card company, is essentially the same, and that runs in the neighborhood of 2 to 2.5%.
Representative,
I understand it, but that there is a fee there. But I'm questioning why there would be a fee there for the bank. I mean, if I give them a check, there's a cost to the bank to process my check as well. In fact, is I love Cub Foods now because no matter where I go, I pay with my finger. And my wife doesn't particularly like it because I'm taking out of her checking account, but I like it. So it would seem to me the merchant likes it. They know that it's not a sufficient. And the bank, there's nobody sitting there trying to do the check thing anymore.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I can't answer for the industry as to why the practices are essentially the same for debit or credit cards. I did point out that there are costs associated with processing checks as well as processing credit cards, so I would guess that in part would be the response of the industry. They still have some transactional costs related to that, but then the further cost of doing the remote processing of that via the internet, the phone lines, that is part of that transaction.
Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not too long ago, we had a presentation by the Workforce Center, and they're switching over to a debit card for payment. Is that debit card going to have payment to it? Is there going to be a charge to that debit card?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Dominguez, I just want to be clear on what I've been saying about the charges or costs of using credit cards. The cost rests with the vendor, the recipient, not the user of it, but to further clarify, when you use it on the internet, there is the possibility, which frequently occurs, that a convenience fee will be charged to use that credit card. The industry allows that, and some, I'd say, frankly, most state agencies and local governments do charge that convenience fee. But with regards to any issues for specifically the debit cards issued by the Workforce Center, I can't answer that. I don't know if the Department of Finance is familiar with that or not.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, what do we do with this now? Are we going to get another recommendation, or are we going to get more thoughts on this, or what do we do with this?
Actually, Mr. Carlson, if you could clarify for us, is there going to be a bill being brought forward, or what is the thoughts of the task force going forward? Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, as I said, Representative Scalzi, the task force could not come up with a consensus, particularly on the shared revenue transactions. Some of us will be meeting and seeing if we can craft legislation that we can bring forward for this committee that will hopefully facilitate addressing the issues that are raised. Again, we're sort of in a quandary where there was not unanimity as to what was the appropriate course.
Okay, further questions? Representative Shumper.
Madam Chair, witness, you know, I live in a rural county, and I think we have 19 townships. I know we have 19 townships in my county, and, you know, I keep thinking, what would be the cost of a township to set up to take credit cards? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd like to ask maybe some of the local governments that are represented here. You know, the larger entities have clearly set up operations to facilitate the use of credit cards. Lori, would you mind?
Please come to the table and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
local governments generally establish a merchant contract through their banking organization,
okay.
And you can negotiate fees in a general rate of 2 to 2.5% for your total activity. So if your townships each set up their contracts, each one could have a different percentage rate.
I see.
Representative Shumper.
Madam Chair, I mean, let's say that this comes about. could townships do this collectively? We have really frugal township government. And, you know, I'm sure if I went to a township officers meeting and talked about this, they would all look at me with a great amount of skepticism, you know, like they really didn't want to get into this. And I understand it would probably be voluntary. Or is that your recommendation, Seth?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Shumper, none of these recommendations, by and large, are mandatory.
Okay.
But I think the collective wisdom of the task force is that, you know, things are changing out there, and we've got to change our practices to manage that. One of our recommendations was to consider state and local government aggregating together to negotiate, hopefully, lower prices. The state, in fact, has done that. They have sort of a master contract that individual agencies can choose or not choose to use. The Department of Revenue is one of those entities that, in fact, does not choose to use that. They have their own negotiated. The county, the Minnesota Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers have negotiated a master contract with one of the credit card companies to try and avail themselves of the negotiating power of banding together. Again, it's certainly possible the townships through its association could do similar things, or even better, you know, all state and local governments could aggregate together and try and negotiate one master contract for every governmental unit in the state of Minnesota.
Okay.
I do have another question. Are you
finished?
Representative Mr. Carlson, sorry. Is there someone from the agencies here that could say what the position of the governor's office might be on doing this, or if the departments have any interest in working with local units of government to help facilitate this from happening, or Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to defer to Mr. Engelbretson, or Mary Ellison was actually the original caller. She's the deputy commissioner from the Department of Public Safety. So if I could ask one of the two of them to come up.
That would be great. Please come to the table and state your name for the record.
Hi, Jerry Engelbretson, Department of Finance. Madam Chair, to answer your first question, at this point in time, this being relatively new, first committee has been in front of, the governor does not have a position on this that I'm aware of, or the Department of Finance. The Department of Public Safety may have some issues, and they are outlined in the report. They may have or be at odds or have a position on some of these issues, but the Department of Finance at this point does not.
Okay. Ms. Ellison, do you have any further advice?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have further advice. I think this is a really, really difficult issue that all of us are faced with, largely because of the, in my view, of the restrictions that the vendor, the credit card industry, puts on us. So for us, we're sort of in a catch-22. We can't charge the customer because Visa and MasterCard won't let us do that for use of a credit card, and we can't afford to just simply absorb all of the fees ourselves. So we're in this catch-22 situation, and I think we're looking for recommendations from the legislature in terms of what the legislature feels is appropriate for state government to do. In terms of negotiating a rate with credit card companies, that isn't something that we talked about with within the task force, but certainly that would be an opportunity. I think that would be a good one for state government to pursue. I have not discussed this with the governor's office at all. It's been our agency's viewpoint that we would like to see the Department of Finance be a leader in that sort of effort, since credit card use crosses all kinds of different state agencies, not just the Department of Public Safety. So we don't feel like we would be the agency necessarily to take the lead on that, but we really haven't discussed it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any further questions from members? If not, thank you. Next we're going to take House File 281, Representative Mull. He was just in the room. If I could get a page to run out into the hall and grab him back in, that would be great. Members, while we wait, we are not going to approve the minutes today or vote on them because I do have a correction that I found myself. So we'll be taking up the minutes in the next regularly scheduled meeting. I also wanted to announce that we're going to be having oversight hearings of the Metropolitan Council and the MAC coming up. The MAC will be on the 26th, MAC is on the 14th. Met Council is on the 21st, and then we're going to take up all Met Council bills on the 26th. So if you intend to introduce legislation on the Metropolitan Council, get them in and get your hearing requests in before the 26th. We're going to do them all in one day, get them all taken care of, and that will be the Met Council day. So it is not my intention to have a different day on MAC or on Metropolitan Council bills. Okay. With that, House File 281, I will move that it be recommended to pass and be moved to finance. With that, go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's the first time I've been before your committee here, so I appreciate your time. I'd like to ask your support for House File 281. It's we'll renew a partnership that's really helped small communities throughout greater Minnesota to meet many of our basic local planning and development needs. Over the years, and many in this committee in particular know this, the legislature has provided modest appropriations which regional development organizations use to help local units of government with local projects. Every dollar that the state has contributed, has provided, has been matched at least dollar for dollar, and many times two and more to one in these efforts to help local units of government actually effectively plan and manage their affairs. The focus of this particular grant program is on small cities, townships, and small counties. In most cases, these are jurisdictions which don't have full-time planning staffs of their own, and rather than require the taxpayers to staff them up at considerable cost to the townships, we can help get these projects done through the regional commissions, as the regional commissions have been very successful in many other ways too. This literally helps our townships and counties, municipalities, stay on the map. This planning approach responds to our local priorities and initiatives that are currently on the ground. The fact that this is a truly locally driven project is a real important aspect of this bill for us. Local governing government officials actually step forward, request these dollars, and are willing to match them dollar for dollar at least. I have representatives from regional development commissions here who would be available to answer specific questions if we need it. And they could tell you about the work also that have been done in the past, as can I have been involved in our local development commission for a few years. And we also have a couple of testifiers here who are going to tell more about the project and give some current information from their area too. I'd first like to introduce, it's Barbara and it's Finnish, right?
Okay.
Yeah, could you pronounce it for us? Barbara
Hoitia.
Hoitia. Yes, being a Norwegian, we can't roll our mouth that way. So I'd like to introduce Barbara Hoitia, city administrator first, and then followed by Jean Short.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Barbara Hoitia. I'm the city administrator in the city of Cambie, and we're located in Yellow Medicine County. Our population is about 1,900. As city administrator of a small city, I wear many hats. I serve as the executive director for the EDA, the executive director for the HRA, I'm the planning and zoning administrator, just to name a few of the things that I do on my day-to-day basis. Receiving some help with planning and developing work would be tremendous benefit to our city. We have some resources that we could apply to this effort, but we don't have the in-house expertise to complete all that we've used to accomplish to maintain zoning ordinances and prepare development opportunities in our area. We've recently used the Region 6W for GIS mapping and developing a comprehensive plan. The provisions of Senator Moe's bill establishes a partnership between the state and our local governments through these regional development commissions and have the expertise to help us complete this planning and development work. Madam Chair and members, there are communities like Cambie throughout the state who would benefit from this type of planning and development partnership. I'm hopeful that the state will move forward with this initiative in 2007 to restore this partnership, which has been so helpful to small communities in the past. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Moe, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Yeah, I'd like to introduce Jean Short, who's the chair of the Regional Development Commission in your area. Can you tell us the name of that?
Thank you, Representative Moe, and thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing us to testify today. Members of the committee and Madam Chair, my name is Gene Short. I'm a Redwood County Commissioner. I'm also the chair of Southwest Regional Development Commission, which is a 9-county regional development commission in the southwest corner of the state of Minnesota. I'm also the past president of the Association of Minnesota Counties. And as Barbara said, we wear many hats, and many of you can tell I've worn many hats in my life, and as Representative Solberg might attest to. When our region received previous grants for local government planning, we worked with counties and several small communities in our region on a variety of projects. And at several occasions, we used our GIS system capabilities to help those local jurisdictions complete important planning and development projects. Among the region's one common theme in the work of local units of government is asking us to do is to update the ordinance books and land use plans, and this is work that must be done in order for smaller communities to be prepared to work on any development project, and industrial, commercial, or residential. In order to help with community development initiatives, we have assisted local units of government with grant writing for parks, trails, design and construction, and we do help provide comprehensive plans which focus on economic development. For some more local information for you, Region 1 has undertaken a Red River Basin natural resources planning work that was needed to be done in the aftermath of the 1998 floods. And for those of you, Region 1 consists of Kitson, Roseau, Marshall, Pennington, Red Lake, Polk, and Norman counties. And moving on to the Region 2, a reservation-wide plan used for Red Lake and Beltrami County housing planning. And Region 2 is Lake of the Woods, Beltrami, Minoman, Clearwater, and Hubbard counties. Region 5 has identified several local jurisdictions in the region who need help with GIS mapping and development, wastewater systems, and affordable housing. Excuse me. Region 5 consists of Cass, Wadena, Crow Wing, Todd, and Morrison counties. Region 60 has done a great deal under this program on database and mapping and needs of local units of government in conjunction with work with local ordinances and land use plans. 60 consists of Candiohi, Meeker, Renville, and McLeod counties. Region 9 has worked on local housing needs, capital improvement planning, and local comprehensive plan revisions. And Region 9 would be Sibley, Nicollet, Le Sueur, Brown, Blue Earth, Waseca, Watt, and Juan Martin, and Faribault counties. We're running out of counties here pretty soon. In every case, it is important work which needs to be done, and most of the local units of government were helping with very limited financial resources, and as a county commissioner, I can attest to that. Most of them do not have planners on staff, and those jurisdictions that do have staff with some planning expertise, especially typically those people are carrying out many other functions for the county, city, or the township. This program allows us to extend some matching resources and bring professional expertise to bear on particular planning and development needs. The work we undertake with these local units of government will help the mayors, the council members, county commissioners, township officers, school board members decide how to accommodate growth or deal with their decline in their respective communities. Whether it's local planning and zoning ordinance, capital improvement plans, housing, or economic development, this planning work helps local officials make better decisions, which can serve valuable and sometimes scarce local resources. If I might end my testimony with Region 8 and tell you what we consist of, and mention one thing that has been done with the hazardous plan status. In order for you to collect on FEMA dollars once you have hazarded in your community, you have to have your plan in place. The Regional Development Commission out of Slayton, Minnesota has prepared the disaster mitigation plans for Redwood County, Nobles County, Murray County. The ones for Rock County are in final provisions. The ones for Jackson County, the plan is in process. Pipestone counties, the grant was approved. Lyon County, the grant was approved. Lincoln County grants in process, and Cottonwood County grant is in process. It's very important that this be done for all of our counties and our communities, because I can remember the floods at least two occasions in my county, and many of you had floods in your jurisdictions as well. But this has been a very positive program for small communities in Greater Minnesota, and I hope we can continue this work in the next year. And I extend my thanks for all of you and for your support, and would remain open for any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Representative Mall, any further comments?
No, I'd like to open up to questions to members of the committee, and then if it's okay with the chair, I'll conclude with a few comments then that are answering questions. Yeah.
Great. Representative Fiskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have a number of questions, and I'll try and pare back. But first, a comment. Representative Moe, I know some members of the nonpartisan research staff don't like titles on bills, but you may want to consider titling this bill hereafter known as the Pandora's Box legislation.
I'll take that under advisement.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, how many regional development commissions currently exist, and how much land mass in the state of Minnesota are not under regional development commissions?
Representative Moe.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biskins, there are people here better prepared to answer that question than I am. Most of the state geographically is covered by regional development commissions, but I'll bring in an expert. Mr. Wiley?
please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Kevin Wally, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Development Organizations. In answer to your question, there are nine actively served regions of the state. There are three areas that don't have an active Regional Development Commission. The St. Cloud area, the Fort County area, which is Denton, Sherburn, Stearns, and Wright, and then the southeastern corner of the state, which is Olmsted, Winona, Houston. I don't know all. I think there's nine counties.
Right.
Is that right? Okay. And then in the Region 4 area, which is Moorhead and Fergus Falls, Alexandria, that area, the Regional Development Commission was dissolved, but the functions of the Regional Development Commission have been picked up by the West Central Initiative Foundation, and they have established a separate board to perform the EDA, Economic Development Administration, functions, and they've certified themselves as a federal EDA region through that board. And they also carry out the transportation planning functions, which are typical of the Regional Development Commission role.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wally. Is there any language which talks of the size of a Regional Development Commission? I mean, does it have to be so many counties? Does it have to include so many people? Can two municipalities get together and call themselves a regional organization?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the Regional Development Commissions were initially established in 1969, and in the Regional Development Act there are specific definitions of the respective regions, and the counties per region are designated in statute. If you read the statute, I don't think there's any prohibition on a reformation, if you will, of the regions currently that are inactive. But that would be a function of the local units of government coming together by agreement to petition for the reestablishment of the commissions. So they are specified in statute, and directly to your question, there are some as small as four counties, and there are some as large as 11 counties, and they were designated, like I said, in 69 based on an executive order. I think it was Governor Levander at the time.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wall, you didn't mention the seven-county metropolitan area in your listing of regional development commissions, so I'm assuming that they're not under one. And then one in this legislation would then be appointed by the commissioner of deed, and I'm wondering what the relationship between this regional development commission would be and the Metropolitan Council.
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, there is no Regional Development Commission for the metro area. There is a Metropolitan Council, and under the Regional Development Act, there's no authority for establishing a redevelopment commission in the metro area. The provisions of Representative Moe's bill would apply only to the area outside of the metro area, and I think there's what we're amending is the Regional Development Act, which has those specific provisions identifying the rural regions of the state. And so there should be no consequence for the metro area from this bill. That would be the intention. And I think the design of the bill.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Wally, then I guess we'd need a little more articulation in the first sentence of Subdivision 5, lines 1.9 and 1.10. Actually, it goes down to 1.12 because that isn't definitive. In fact, I think it says wherever there is no regional development commission, then a regional organization. So, like, now I suppose deed could select the Metropolitan Council as that commission. And I suppose I'd have to know where in statute this is also being placed to have that clarification. I do have a couple of other questions that I'd like to ask.
Can we get clarification first on this first question that you asked? Let's take them one at a time. Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the context for this provision is it's amending MnSTAT Section 462.39, which is the Regional Development Act, which pertains only to the greater Minnesota regions. And so when we're talking in the local planning assistance, and considering identifying entities that might perform these functions in areas not currently served by regional development commissions, the metro area, the 7th County metro area, is specifically excluded, and the objective would be to identify an area, for example, in the southeast region and the St. Cloud area. As I mentioned, the Fergus Falls, Moorhead, Alexandria region has an entity that is filling this role, and so the designee there would be the West Central Initiative Foundation.
Okay, Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, two other questions.
Okay, great.
If
the
Chair would indulge me. Thank you very much. Representative Moll, would it be your intent that this Regional Development Commission have veto authority over local comp plans that aren't agreeing with the overarching planning agent?
Representative Biskins, no. And my understanding, and again, Mr. Wally, who is much more aware of the statutes pertaining to the Regional Development Commissions, could show you in statute where they don't have the authority to do so. But just to back up a little bit, your line of questioning, Representative Biskins, I know from our conversations in the past and your comments on the House floor that you're one who likes efficiency in government, economies of scale, likes to get the best value out of our tax dollars to hold down taxes, in particular in this case, property taxes as much as possible. And this is the Regional Development Commissions are how Greater Minnesota, much like the Met Council here in the metropolitan area, is able to use economies of scale to collectively try and use local expertise as efficiently as possible and not duplicating these positions needlessly. So this actually allows us to do things efficiently, effectively, and save tax dollar money. That's the intention of the development commissions, and effectively, that's what they do. Oftentimes, and many members here know this, these are the organizing forces in Greater Minnesota that allow us to do many of the things that here in the legislature we expect to have done: clean water, planned roads, economic development. So I understand, you know, your concern about our tax dollars, and I appreciate that. So am I, and that's behind this bill as well.
All right, one further question, Representative Biskins, and then Representative Schumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Moe, I guess that brings me to the very last question, and it's a nice segue because as I look at the bill on lines 2.15 and 2.16, that last sentence seems to necessitate, in fact, mandate a tax increase at the local level because there is no... it says that the money must be appropriated to these commissions, but then it says that each grant must be matched dollar for dollar by non-state money. So is it your intent to necessitate a tax increase?
You can correct me, Mr. Wally.
Representative Mull.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, as you know, local units of government currently assess property taxes and get state local government aid for a variety of projects that they're responsible for doing, and yet aren't able to leverage enough money to actually accomplish that. The intent of this legislation and the development commissions historically is to match those revenues that are currently on the table. This does not necessitate any additional taxes.
All right. Representative Schumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moe, about the match money, can that come from other than local governments?
Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schumper, any revenue available to those local units of government who are actually attempting to do the projects stated in legislation.
For example, a foundation. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, a foundation could contribute to a half a dozen small cities to help them upgrade their water plan or do the match instead of the small cities.
Madam Chair,
Representative
Schumper, that is in fact the case, and thinking as you know, that's in fact what does happen.
Yes. Okay.
Representative
Schumper. Madam Chair, just one last question. It sounds like a lot of this is occurring already from the testimony of your witnesses. So why do you need this special legislation?
Representative Mull.
Madam Chair, Mr. Wally has been anxious to respond here, so I'll yield.
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper. I think it's a question of scale in many cases for these communities. The smaller the community, the tighter the resources, the less the ability to carry out these functions. Some of this is going on now because the regions have some capabilities and some of the larger communities have resources to bring to bear to match. A lot of these resources are intended to serve the smaller counties, the smaller cities, to make sure that they can bring resources to bear. And you're quite right on the matching amounts. And indeed, in some cases, we've been able to bring more than a one-to-one match to bear on this.
All right. Next is Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know how many of you have had the experience of serving on a Regional Development Commission, but I have. I was on our commission in Region 4 almost from its beginning in 1974 until it was disbanded in 1982. And I was in the minority trying to keep the commission going because I saw an important role that was being played by the Regional Development Commission. And one of the arguments that I made as we tried to save our organization was we needed planning technical assistance for smaller communities that didn't have those resources. And so, Representative Moe, you're on the right track here. This planning assistance is very important. And we're talking about technical assistance here. We're not talking about the Regional Development Commission's dictating to local communities what they can or cannot do. Local communities come to the RDC and request assistance in helping them do the appropriate planning. And those of you that are more familiar with Met Council, please don't equate Regional Development Commissions with Met Council because they're very different animals. They don't have anywhere near the clout or the capacity to influence things that happen in the metropolitan area is much different from what it is in greater Minnesota. So that by way of background, I just had one question, if I might ask Representative Moe. For those areas such as mine that doesn't have an operating RDC right now, what will be the process for deed determining exactly who is going to be eligible for this funding and how that will be handled?
Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I'm going to respond quickly, and then I'm also going to ask Mr. White. First, I'd like to thank Representative Lanning for carrying the torch for a few years there. This, as he knows, these are integral organizations in greater Minnesota. And specifically, I would assume, and maybe you probably know the answer to this better than I do, the status of efforts in your area to become affiliated with or organize as a development commission. So maybe you could respond after Mr. Wally does to that question.
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, in the various areas that aren't served, the West Central Initiative Fund is the logical entity. West Central Initiative Foundation is the logical entity there because they have taken on those roles already. In the St. Cloud area, there was a group that came to the legislature, I'm going to say 4 or 5 years ago, to receive received an appropriation from the state to undertake a multi-county planning process. I honestly don't know whether that entity has continued on, but that would be the logical entity for deed to examine for the St. Cloud area. And in southeast Minnesota, there are some multi-county entities that do exist. There's a multi-county HRA. There's, I can't remember the name of the organization. There's another multi-county entity in the area that would be a likely candidate for that function. That's the area that I have the least certainty about with respect to who deed might ultimately identify as the entity.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Lanning?
No, at this point I don't know whether the West Central Initiative Fund would willingly accept this, but they would be a logical group to go to.
Representative Goldberg.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I appreciate Representative Moe bringing this forward, and also the testimony of Mr. Short and Mr. Wally, and when you're talking about small cities. You know, 80% of our cities are under 2,500. And I don't know of any of those that have a full-time planner. If anything, they're contracting out with a planner. And, you know, I'm hoping that some of the work that these commissions could do would replicate what was done through the Star Cities program back when it was DTED at the time. Great program. We went through it in Dilworth. It was like an 11, 12-step process. And you had to do 1 and 5 year goals and capital improvements. You had to look at your strengths and weaknesses, do a survey, have a brochure, a video. And then at the very end, a fictitious business, which would be someone from DTED, would come out and they would want to develop a business there, and you'd have to have this presentation. But I know what it did in Dilworth. It had us look at the fact that our goal in the long term wasn't going to be in chasing smokestacks, but our economic development was going to be in new housing, you know, and quality of life being a bedroom community. And without that assistance, I don't know if Dilworth would have moved forward necessarily. And I've always thought of having circuit planners where you go around to all these various cities, because many of these cities need a visioning process. They really do, to really analyze what are their strengths and weaknesses. And too many times they're hoping for this huge big smokestack that's going to save the day for them that is never going to come. And so this would be very valuable for these small cities that don't have the resources to have a planner to look into that, but they could have that type of an assistance. And I'm hoping this could do some of that, because I do think that the very survival for many of these smaller cities in Minnesota is having some sort of a plan, and a realistic one, but they need the assistance to do that. And I guess any reaction to that, if that could be part of what this does, or does it do it already, and so forth.
Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, thank you. I'll speak to it again briefly, and I know Mr. Wally here is quickly jotting things down, so he has some thoughts in mind too. There's several small cities that I represent as well that would benefit greatly from this. And the one that sticks in my mind most is Cass Lake, Minnesota, per capita, probably the poorest town in our state. The Development Commission, the Regional Development Commission there, has been integral with Cass Lake, trying to remake its storefronts downtown to actually attract a few businesses. There's a Superfund site. It has helped them coordinate the planning process for actually ultimately, ideally, getting that cleaned up. It's coordinated housing development initiative for the small city of Cass Lake. This would provide tools to the initiative foundations to do more of that work. And so, as we know, our small towns really are challenged in so many ways. And so this would help them to help themselves. But Mr. Waller?
Madam Chair, I think you nailed it.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Next on the list is Representative Schumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moe, quick question. Do the Regional Development Commissions get the $75,000 no matter what, or do they have to produce a program to support local planning each year?
Representative Moe. Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, they're not going to get a check from the Department of Employment and Economic Development without indicating what it is they intend to do with it.
Representative Scaldi.
Yeah, I just had a comment coming from representing small suburban cities who really struggle coming up with the planning funds. And I, you know, Met Council here pretty much tells us that we have to do planning, and so then we have to spend the money and we have to budget for it. And most of my cities either share a planner or just do a contract planner. For this type of thing, we had to budget ahead a year, and it was very difficult for us, too. I mean, there's suburban cities who really don't have a lot of money to do this kind of thing. And I'm just wondering, since we do share so many people and technical assistance in the smaller suburbs, I'm wondering if you've thought of that out of your own funds rather than having the state fund it. You know, do you share funds like that for technical people that would provide the same service rather than the state fund it?
Representative Moe.
Yeah, I'll respond, and then if Mr. Wally has anything to add. First up, Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, I would be glad to support any efforts for suburban cooperation as well as we go through the legislature. I understand that's a need, too. But there are sundry efforts where local units of government partner together for economies of scale. They're forced to. I mean, we, as you know, you're from the north, you know that there's not a whole lot of money up in Baudette. And the communities need to do that. And in fact, that's essentially, I mean, you re-explained the project. That's essentially what this is going to give them greater ability to do, to pool our resources, to plan in a coordinated, effective way, as opposed to having one half-time administrator that's responsible for doing everything and literally doesn't have the time or ability to do that.
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, I could readily envision, and I know that this has actually been done in previous rounds for local planning assistance, where resources from the local communities, individual cities who have wanted to avail themselves of these services, have been brought to bear with the state resources, and then the regional development commissions in some instances have used RDC resources to provide a match for a match for a match in order to stretch resources in a cooperative way. And so I would envision more of that taking place here. So there is a genuine partnership, if you will, among the various communities who want these services and need these services.
Representative Galvey, a follow-up? All right. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Moe, I noticed that for the unenlightened areas, I mean the areas of the state not covered by regional development commissions, that the regional organization would be appointed by the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development. I guess my question is, how does a member become a member of a regional development commission right now?
Representative Ball.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, are you referring to how does somebody get on the board of a regional development commission?
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Yeah, that's correct. Madam Chair, Representative Moe. Yeah, how does one become a commissioner?
Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Wally to give you the process and statute, how that has to happen.
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the statute provides for representation from each of the regions in each of the regional development commission areas. The county boards identify or name the county commissioner to represent them on the board. There's also provision in statute for representation from cities over a certain population. I think the threshold is 10,000 population. So either a mayor or a council member is designated from each of those larger communities. Then there's a representative from the smaller communities, and that's by election. A vote per smaller city, for example, gets to elect a councillor or mayor representing that group on the commission, and that's a small city representative from each county. And then there's the township officers in each county are elect a representative for the township officers for each county to the commission as well. And then there are two school board representatives by statute that are elected from among the school board members in the whole region to the commission. So there is specific county, large city, small city, township, and school board representation under the Regional Development Act for commission makeup. Oh, and all the tribes, the tribes also have a representative.
Just a thought, Madam Chair. So they are all elected officials, but nobody actually runs to be on the Regional Development Commission, and I'm wondering if that might be a favorable amendment to a bill that Representative Hornstein is carrying. I'll ask. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Further questions? All right, if not, I'm going to ask if there's anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill.
Madam Chair, I know Kent Solem from the Association of Minnesota Townships is here, and he's expressed interest and support for the Township Association. Am I correct?
Okay. Anyone like to come and testify for or against? All right, if not, I will renew my motion that House File 281 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you so much. With that, members.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you.
With that, members, our business is done for today, so I will adjourn the meeting. Meeting adjourned.